Hello and welcome to the Dense City Podcast, a show where we meet with academics to discuss their research on cities. I'm your co-host, Isaac Keast. Today we welcome Drs. Catherine Einstein, David Glick, and Maxwell Palmer from the Department of Political Science at Boston University. Catherine received her PhD from Harvard in Government and Social Policy and Political Science, Max from Harvard in Political Science, and David received his PhD in Politics from Princeton. Among their research interests are urban politics and policy, racial and ethnic policies, and American political institutions. Between them, their work has been published in a variety of sources, including the American and British Journals of Political Science, Perspectives on Politics, Political Behavior, Political Science Quarterly, and Urban Affairs Review. We'll be discussing their book, Neighborhood Defenders, Participatory Politics and America's Housing Crisis, published in 2019. The book is premised on how local political inequalities can end up limiting the housing supply and contributing to the current housing crisis. Participatory institutions like local neighborhood committees often notify neighbors themselves and solicit comments on proposed housing developments, taking an active role for better or worse. This book shows how, despite all being welcome to the discussion, those who choose to participate frequently hold overwhelmingly negative views of new housing projects and are often socioeconomically advantaged. These active groups and individuals, who this book terms neighborhood defenders, are able to raise enough concerns that lengthy delays become the norm, costs increase, and unit counts dwindle. Today, this gives us a housing supply that is too low density to offer affordable housing or even to sustain the infrastructure needs of our cities. So how did this become the case, and how do we make sure that certain groups don't undermine planning priorities? Let's get into the episode and discuss. Welcome, everybody, to the Density Podcast, and happy 2024. This is our first recording of the new year. So thanks for coming on short notice. And we're talking about your book, Neighborhood Defenders, Participatory Politics and America's Housing Crisis. And it seems to sort of bring to the forefront the issue of the role of the public in the planning process. And there's, of course, lots of literature pointing to why that's a good thing, but there's also some negatives to it. So what brought this issue to your attention and made you want to research it?
So there's been a lot of economics research that has shown that land use regulations increase housing costs. And people have analyzed this using a lot of different data, studied it in a lot of different ways. But as political scientists, when we looked at those results, we were really interested in better understanding what was going on underneath the hood. What were the politics of those land use regulations, and how were they shaping the actual housing development process? And that very quickly led us to these community meetings, because one really important facet of those land use regulations is the way that they're structured in most American cities. It means that anytime you want to build more than one unit of housing, more often than not, you as a developer are going to find yourself presenting your plans in one of these community forums. And so it felt to us as researchers that if we were really going to understand how regulations were shaping the development of new housing, we were really going to have to understand the dynamics of those community meetings, who was showing up, what they were saying, and how they were impacting decision making.
I would also add, before we started the book, we were working on a paper about the same question. We were sort of coming at it more thinking about regulation, less about the people. But at the same time, I was living in Cambridge in a neighborhood where right down the street from me, they were trying to, developers trying to convert a warehouse into a new condo building. And I saw my neighbors sort of mobilize to change it, to try to stop it, to reduce the amount of housing that got built. I think I really before then hadn't been exposed personally to the politics of development like that. And that sort of got us talking a lot among the three of us about regulations, about development, about all the different challenges of the many steps and stages and studies that the developers had to go through to get anything built.
Okay, so it kind of seems like your prior research kind of led you here. So that's interesting. Now, getting to the actual book itself, considering the premise of your book, can you walk us through the purpose and sort of what you were looking to explore with it?
So I think what we were really interested in doing was really critically evaluating those community meetings and understanding what was happening there. Because I think in a lot of urban planning research, and frankly, a lot of political science research too, people thought really positively about these community forums. They were a way of enhancing trust in, you know, urban planning processes. They were a way of ensuring that community voices were heard. And so what we really wanted to do was go out and understand, okay, what empirically is actually happening at these meetings. And so what we did is we read thousands of pages of meeting minutes so that we could understand what was being said at those meetings and who was speaking up at those meetings. And we were able to sort of combine what we learned from those thousands of pages of meeting minutes with other administrative data sources to be able to show that the people who attend public meetings are deeply unrepresentative of their broader communities. They're privileged on a variety of dimensions. They're way more likely to be homeowners. They're way more likely to be over the age of 50. They're somewhat more likely to be white as well. And perhaps most importantly, they are overwhelmingly opposed to the construction of new housing. Only 13% of people who show up to those public hearings turn out to be supportive of new housing developments. And so it tells us that when you have these community processes, you are hearing from a very specific slice of the population expressing very intense and oppositional views that make it difficult to build housing.
And this is a really tricky question to answer. And Katie mentioned that we read thousands of pages of meeting minutes and coded up all these comments and what people were talking about. But in Massachusetts and just a few other places, they record both the names and the addresses of every commenter. So we matched these people to property records to figure out if they were homeowners or not, and matched them to a voter file, a list of registered voters to figure out if they vote, and to use that to figure out their age, to estimate their race and other demographics. And so this is a huge undertaking, but was really essential to try to figure out who are these people and how are they different from others in their community who don't show up to these meetings and who don't speak on these issues.
Right. So the purpose of the book was sort of dissecting the public hearing and sort of figuring what's going on, what exactly is going on there.
Just adding one more perspective, just to add to Katie and Max's answers a little bit. It was, you know, I think to understand the meetings as processes and institutions that people are a part of, but to sort of combine insights about sort of the individual people who show up, but in a kind of a structural institutional approach, and really to sort of pull those two together.
Right. Yeah. Figuring out if it in any way actually represents the broader population to me seems super critical. And many people might not actually be aware of how the public is invited or how they're involved at all. So could you maybe describe or give us just a cursory knowledge of where the public comes in? Or if I was, you know, proposing a multifamily development, what would the basic process look like?
Yeah, so Max brought up a warehouse renovation example, which I think is a nice way of sort of getting into this a little bit. So the example that we actually used to open our book is the redevelopment of a warehouse near a mass transportation stop in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so a developer purchased this commercial warehouse and wanted to make it into four condominium units, each with one parking space. Because that developer was proposing changing a commercial use into a residential use, that required a variance from the local zoning board, and it required a special permit from the planning department, right? So it required, because of the way that regulations were set up, it required this developer to present their plans to local zoning and planning board officials. When you go before those local boards, it's not just the public officials who are there. Members of the general public are invited to participate in those proceedings, right? And so the way that this typically goes is that a developer is going to go before the board and present their plans, and then members of the public are invited to speak up. So in the example of this Cambridge warehouse redevelopment, the developer, you know, goes before the planning board, presents their plans, gets asked a few pretty technocratic questions. The planning board seems in general pretty supportive. And then members of the public have a chance to speak, and they are not happy. So the neighbors show up to this meeting and express concerns about whether decks from this condominium development are going to impinge upon their privacy, whether it will introduce new shadows onto their yards, whether it might cause structural issues in their homes, right, and so on. And so after hearing from the neighbors, members of the planning commission were, you know, considerably less supportive of the plan and said, you need to go back and to the developer and talk to the neighbors more. You need to do a structural engineering study and a parking study and like come back to us in a couple of months, right? So the developer does all those things, those studies, right? Each cost maybe $10,000, give or take. They have a few extra months of delay. And then they come back and they say, okay, now we're going to have a development after talking with the neighbors with 3 condominium units, each with 2 parking spaces. And so at one level, you might interpret that story and say, well, that's great. That's how the community process is supposed to work. There's like a little bit of give and take happening there. And everyone sort of got what they wanted. But when we think about that process in the context of a housing crisis, where we have a region like Greater Boston that has been significantly underbuilding housing relative to demand, and we think about that process repeating itself thousands of times over, we are making it much harder to build new housing. And those little processes are creating a significant housing shortfall when taken in the aggregate.
Hmm. Right. So it's like the process is drawn out, and that, I mean, is compounded because the result is less units. And yeah, when that is happening on every single development, it's hard to make serious progress. So thank you for walking us through that.
One of the things we tried to be careful and thorough about is thinking through both, there's like who's formally invited or who gets a notice in the mail, you know, saying there's this proposal in your neighborhood or whatnot. And then who's kind of functionally invited, or who's, even if there were no official sort of invites going out in the mail, for example, like who's most likely to show up, right? And this gets to something we talk a lot about in the book, the sort of issue of concentrated costs and diffuse benefits, right? So even in a world where formally all of the public, at least in the community, and that's a different question, of course, that potential beneficiaries currently live elsewhere, exactly for the dynamics we're talking about, that you can have a world where everyone in the community is formally invited, right? In a world where, you know, the potential impacts on views and traffic and perceived concerns and things are much more locally concentrated just by kind of the nature of the structure, with or without sending out any official invite, you're likely to get a pretty skewed population. And that's, you know, the kind of thing we try to be careful about thinking through, the kind of official who's invited and the just the more structural. If you just set up this system the way it is, who's going to inevitably show up, which is why you just see the same patterns over and over again.
Yeah, like when we think about sort of policy recommendations in the book, right, we really think that cities need to move away from this project by project community review process, because there is no way to restructure the meetings to get sort of a broader array of people to show up when the reality is the only people who are going to really care about a 4-unit condominium development proposal are the folks who live right nearby, who are going to face the concentrated costs of that development, the construction noise, the, you know, the blasting, like whatever it is, right? Those are the people who are most sort of directly impacted. And the benefits of building 4 condominium units, they're quite diffuse, right? That we need that in the aggregate, but each individual unit of housing is not really having a perceptible impact on housing costs. And so the beneficiaries don't have the same incentive to show up as the opponents when we're talking about this project by project review process.
Right.
I mean, we, the 3 of us, I think it's not really a secret reading our book, like, are incredibly pro-housing people. And, you know, maybe Max and David can correct me. Maybe you guys in your free time are going to tons of community meetings, but we are not like attending every community meeting in our own areas about every individual housing development, even though we fervently support building new housing, because again, the benefits of each individual project are so diffuse. So it's just not reasonable to expect even the best organized pro-housing movement to sort of be able to mobilize for every single individual project.
And this is even more complicated in a place like Massachusetts, where we're fragmented across many municipalities, and every place has its own meetings, has its own process, but it's a regional housing issue. And so fixing it in any one town, you know, even mobilizing only one in any one town isn't enough. And the people who might benefit from that new housing can come from anywhere in the area or outside the area. And so it's not even the case that, you know, mobilizing and organizing in one place is enough given the structure of these meetings.
Yeah, it's impossible. Like, the 3 of you couldn't attend every meeting and have your voice heard. But there's always going to be people living next door who are going to be opposed. So it's a good point. Before we go much further, I wanted to bring up the topic of NIMBYs, not in my backyard people. And Taylor, your book is Neighborhood Defenders. Are neighborhood defenders NIMBYs, or can you kind of define the neighborhood defender or make a distinction there?
Yeah, so we take the term neighborhood defender. We're not like the inventors of this. I first just want to make very clear that this was a term that was used a lot in research around school integration battles. So this is sort of something that a lot of other scholars have thought about and thought about sort of the way that neighborhood and community can mobilize people to politically participate. But one reason we wanted to move away from this not in my backyard framework is that framework fundamentally portrays the folks who oppose housing as being sort of selfishly and, you know, concerned about their own property values, and that being the primary motivator to show up and oppose new housing. And I think that is absolutely a component for a large number of people who oppose new housing. So there are absolutely people who are very worried that a new development is going to threaten their property values, and like that's what's motivating them to show up. But our experience, both reading these meeting minutes and interviewing people, is that a lot of the folks who show up to these meetings conceive of themselves as protecting their broader community. And so they might be raising, you know, sort of genuine environmental concerns, or really think that sort of new traffic will ruin their community, not from a property value sense, but just from sort of an overall disruption to what they like about their neighborhood. And so we really felt that the term neighborhood defender more accurately captured how the folks who oppose housing conceive of themselves. Because I think for the average person, if you sort of convince them, oh, you're actually just being super selfish, it might be easier to move the needle in some ways. I actually think one of the reasons that it is so hard to get around this opposition is a lot of opponents to new housing genuinely believe that they are being unselfish protectors of the neighborhood and of the community.
That makes a lot of sense. That's an important distinction. Yeah. There are people who have legitimate concerns. I guess maybe they kind of feel empowered through that. Their concern is just as legitimate as yours or mine might be about not having enough housing. You know, that's kind of what they would think. So
I also think it helps to understand why these comments can have such an impact on public officials, because as a public official, it's much more easy to dismiss sort of a neighborhood crank who's saying like, ah, oh, this is going to ruin my property value. You're like, well, but we have to think about the broader neighborhood. But if someone comes in and says, I'm really worried about flooding concerns, and I'm really worried about what this new development is going to do to this endangered species of bird living in my community, right? Those feel like potentially much more impactful comments and ones that a public official is naturally going to take more seriously.
Right.
I was going to say the same thing about the way that comments are heard. The one thing that we can't do and don't do in the book is we can't differentiate when a concern is a sincere concern versus a tactic designed to stop housing in general. And we have that has to be happening at least sometimes with people raising any issue they can to stop something they don't like versus raising sincere concerns. But I think approaching it as sincere concerns is a useful way in, instead of just saying they're opposed to everything no matter what.
Yeah, I want to emphasize that tactical point. It's super important because one of the questions we get a lot is like, how much of this is, you know, racism or classism? And the answer is probably some of it, but because of social desirability bias, very few people are going to show up to a public meeting and say, I don't want that new housing because I don't like the kinds of people who I think are going to live here, right? They're going to come up again with something that's much more socially acceptable about the environment or about traffic. And we're just reading the meeting minutes. We are not mind readers, so we cannot know for sure whether someone is legitimately worried about the environment or whether they're using concerns about the environment to mask racial or class-based biases.
Right.
And just back to our kind of the structural point, it almost doesn't matter in some sense, the sincerity of the concerns, the government is still, because of the structures that you were asking about earlier and we were talking about, the government's going to hear a sort of skewed set of perspectives, however sincere or not. And so to some extent, you know, we think dismissing it as just NIMBYs is kind of overly simplistic or shifts the focus too much on individuals and individual motivation and not the the kind of inherently, you know, skewed structures.
It's deeper than NIMBYism.
Yeah, it's too simple. Yeah.
Yeah. And dismissing it isn't going to solve the problem. Yeah, this is an interesting distinction. This question lasted longer than I expected because it's a really good answer. I'm not sure how it works in Boston, but here often they present in front of a council and those councillors are not exactly planners. So the councillors are then, you know, they don't want to look dismissive or, you know, like they don't care about the environment. So they assign maybe too much weight to what the person is saying just because they want to appear responsible and everything too. But anyway, I want to ask, so what existing theories are there in the literature to tell us more about this issue?
You know, I think David raised it earlier, and I think to us, the framework of concentrated costs and diffuse benefits, which, you know, it's one that's used in a lot of economics, a lot of political science, I think really helps us to understand this sort of broader structural problem and why this can't just be fixed by sort of making like little tweaks to public meetings. Like, again, one of the questions we've gotten asked a lot is sort of, oh, can we, you know, hold public meetings at more convenient times? Can we move them online? Like, could Zoom really help with this, right? Sort of what little fixes can we do to make public meetings better? And we, both the concentrated costs and diffuse benefits literature and sort of subsequent research that we've done really show that this is a structural problem that cannot be addressed with those sorts of minor tweaks. And again, that's because fundamentally, a project by project review process is always going to attract the people who feel really intensely about that project, who are the people who live nearby facing those concentrated costs. So I think that's sort of the framework that to us helps us to best understand and why we have this sort of bigger structural problem and why any fixes to it are fundamentally going to involve state, federal, or like city level decision-making processes, that this cannot be a neighborhood by neighborhood project review process.
Hmm. So that, I'm not sure if I'm going to say it right, but the concentrated costs and diffuse benefits.
Yeah.
That literature sort of, it seems like, formed the basis for a lot of what you've talked about in this book.
Yeah. And I think pushes against, you know, if you're sort of asking about other literatures that maybe we're like pushing against a little bit, the idea that, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of urban planning work, that community engagement fundamentally leads to sort of better outcomes. I think we push against that a little bit and sort of say, well, if you have this project by project review process, it could actually be that community engagement leads to really suboptimal outcomes in this particular policy sphere.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense when you combine that with the other literature, you know, concentrated costs, diffuse benefits, it makes sense. You can really explain why you'll see that everywhere and why participatory planning doesn't lead to the utopia that maybe we think it does. I'll move now into the main takeaways of the book, because I think it's pretty obvious to listeners now the implications of this. You know, it leads to less housing, it exacerbates the housing crisis. So what are the main takeaways from your book and how do we deal with them?
So I guess I'll throw out one policy proposal, and then yeah, Max and David, you guys should like jump in, because we have a whole series of different policy suggestions. I think the first big implication that we want people to take away from our book is that we should not be building housing in this discretionary project by project review process. That creates, you know, unpredictability for developers. It is always going to attract sort of this unrepresentative, highly skewed group to attend and to delay developments, to shrink them, and to contribute to this sort of housing crisis. And so the best solution to this is to set zoning to sort of the level that, you know, local governments or state governments, right? You can debate which level of government we want to set this, right? But set the zoning to be sort of what we deem socially desirable, and then let developers build up to that the limits of that zoning without a discretionary review process. So to create predictability, to make it so that a developer knows when they submit their plans and it gets approved by the planning commission, that sort of this is the process that will lead to that'll create more predictability.
Hmm.
So yeah, I don't know, Max or David, if you guys want to jump in with some of the other suggestions that we had in the book and sort of thinking about how to move us away in sort of different facets from this discretionary neighborhood project by project review process.
I think a second set of thoughts we have is about how planning boards and zoning boards and all should think about the feedback that they receive. And so I think our finding about how unrepresentative the people who comment are of their communities is really helpful, and that planning boards shouldn't think about the feedback they hear as representative of the community as a whole. And they should think about who shows up, who participates, and how they're systematically different. And then the fact that people who might like this housing, who might get small benefits or not see big costs, aren't going to show up, in how that sort of feedback is received and considered. And then that relates to how they then make decisions. In particular, that requests for studies sort of seem innocuous. We should just get more information about the impact of something, but that's time-consuming and very costly for developers. That ultimately reduces the amount of housing that gets built and how long it takes to build it. It makes housing more expensive. And so they shouldn't just think about, you know, granting every request, continuing every meeting to the future, because that's really costly and hurts and reduces the production of new housing. And then that they should really think about when they're making decisions, they might be really unpopular in the room because they're facing a group of people who oppose these projects, but that pressure shouldn't affect their ultimate decision-making. We suggest that maybe kind of separate out that decision, whether to continue to a future meeting, whether to approve, shouldn't be immediately done in that room where they've just heard from a big group of opponents.
So kind of like treating everyone like human beings and being like, you know, counselors are going to have emotional responses. They're going to feel maybe compelled to side with the people in the room, but maybe we need to give some space there so they don't feel like that's required of them.
Exactly. Or at least thinking about the fact that they're going to feel that pressure and taking that into account. You know, I think making it clear and explicit is useful for thinking about their biases and our own biases about how this process should go.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the meetings I've been a part of. And yeah, you can kind of feel it in the room, the tide starting to turn. And, you know, you described it earlier, when it's presented, everyone seems pretty supportive. And then as voices come out, people kind of change their mind. And I mean, I would wager a guess that many of the elected officials have not heard of condensed costs and dispersed benefits. But having that in your mind and being aware of that every time someone comes up to the podium to speak would really help, I think, you know, assign weights to what everyone's saying.
One thing we've actually heard people doing, which this is making me the worst book salesperson ever, but we have a one-page summary of some of the key arguments of our book on our website. And we've actually had sort of people in the greater Boston area, like literally print this out and hand it out to public officials at meetings. And you know, we haven't done a rigorous evaluation to know whether this has like increased the housing supply or changed hearts and minds. But it has led to public officials being aware of the biases that they're observing sort of in the room. So, you know, I think we're always open to thinking about different ways to sort of communicate science in ways that are clear to public officials. But Max's point about sort of getting public officials to be aware of those biases, I think can be enormously powerful in having public officials at least contextualize who they're hearing from in the room.
Totally.
And our website is housingpolitics.com. I would just add one other thing related to this is that if you're a supporter of a development and you're in the room and the first 10 comments have all been very negative, you might not want to stand up and speak anymore. And so the voices that we hear might be even less representative than the people who shut up in the first place because of that social pressure and it being really difficult to make that positive comment when most of the comments of everybody sitting around you are negative.
Yeah, those social pressures, I think, are especially potent when we're talking about like smaller communities, right? Mm. So, you know, I think a lot of attention has rightfully been on sort of what the dynamics are in big cities in like Boston or Toronto or San Francisco. But when we're talking about some of the small suburban communities, you know, I served on the planning board in a suburb of Boston that I live in. And the people whose voices I hear from, they're like the parents of my kids' classmates. And so there's, you know these folks and you don't want to create sort of, you know, challenging social dynamics, right? And so I absolutely think that that plays an important role in public officials' bias maybe towards compromise. Those sort of social pressures and dynamics I think are really important.
Totally. Yeah. If you're a small town, your developer probably is using money from out of town and, you know, the people are going to be saying, well, I'm your neighbor. So who do you care more about? So yeah, we're all human. And that leads to my next question. I'm not sure if it's any different in the United States, but almost every planning decision ultimately gets made by a council who may have zero experience with planning. So do you have any experience with this or opinions on it?
So, I mean, I think it's a really interesting bigger question in local politics, right? Is yeah. Sort of how much of our decision making about, say, housing developments, you know, you raised the example of elected officials, right? And elected officials naturally are going to face all sorts of political pressures and might be making a fundamentally political choice as opposed to one that is rooted in sort of planning best practices. But I also want to flag that a lot of this decision making isn't even made by elected officials, but by like volunteers. So when I served on a planning board whose job it was to provide special permits for housing developments, that was a 100% volunteer position. And so once every 2 weeks, you know, the five of us would meet for 3 hours in the evening to review, you know, different special permit projects. And so each of us had some forms of expertise. You know, I study zoning as an academic. There are folks who are like architects and developers. So there was some subset of expertise, but we were fundamentally citizen volunteers. And obviously the backgrounds of those citizen volunteers are going to vary considerably depending upon the city or town that you're looking at. So no, I think this is a really tricky problem in urban politics, and like how much decision-making is actually held in the hands of folks who may or may not have the baseline expertise to address these challenges, right? So that's sort of one thing, like, do these people actually know about planning best practices? And then the second issue, the one you raise, is sort of for elected officials, how much are they following planning best practices and how much are they politicians who are fundamentally concerned about the electoral pressures they're experiencing from the loudest voices in the room?
Yeah, I just wanted to have a discussion about it because I feel like that kind of is where this conversation circles. And I guess there's a couple questions I skipped over that I just want to circle back to. Neighborhood character is something that we hear a lot about. And I wanted to know how that comes up in arguments and how that can kind of affect a development.
I think like a lot of sort of our conversation about neighborhood defenders, right? Like I think there are people who are genuinely concerned about their neighborhood character. And then I think there are people who might use it as a tactic. There's also obviously, you know, I think correct in many cases, concerns that people raise this sort of vague specter of neighborhood character when what they're actually worried about is the racial or socioeconomic composition of who is living in that neighborhood. Mm. So yeah, I think it again, it's a powerful motivator to housing opponents. And, you know, I think again, our research is less about sort of the legitimacy of those complaints and more about the fact that structurally, the way that housing development processes are set up is that we are going to always hear from opponents and that's going to make it harder to build. Mm. And even if those opponents have very reasonable objections, their objections should be weighed against the broader societal benefits of building housing. And, you know, again, I think just to bring that point home, I live like right next door right now to a multi-development housing project that's going on. It's just like a little 2-unit development. And a couple of days ago, they were tearing down asbestos tiles, which is not like delightful to live next door to, right? So if I were so inclined, that's the kind of thing I could go to like a public meeting and complain about, right? And it would be a very understandable complaint. I think most people would not like to live next door to, you know, flying asbestos tiles as part of a construction removal process. But what we all, I think, want governments to do is to weigh those very real concentrated costs of housing development with the incredibly important benefits that new housing provides and our desperate need as a broader society to have that new housing. And so even, you know, if there are 2 or 3 dissatisfied neighbors who are not happy about living next door to a development, are their concerns really worth blocking or shrinking a development in the context of a regional housing crisis?
Hmm. I'm just connecting this, like, this is like the whole purpose of government, you know, to say like these people have concerns, but we need to put them on hold because we have bigger concerns that involve everybody.
Right. But one thing that's distinct about housing politics is we have this notion that we should have a voice in what our neighbors can do and in what is built around us. And it's not just our own property, our own lives, but how the environment around us affects our lives.
Right.
And it does. It's totally understandable. But I think that housing creates, and the permanency of it, that we, especially if you own land or you've been there a long time, you know, that housing creates a notion that we want to influence how the areas around us change and not just our own land. And that we should have a voice in it that's different, I think, from other policy areas that also affect us on a day-to-day level, but are a little bit more abstract, or at least not just so immediately next door.
Right. Yeah, our last guest, he was talking about also the anomaly of housing you just described, of how people, it's like they think their neighbor's land is like this weird semi space between private and public. It's somehow also theirs because it so intimately affects their land, but it's obviously not theirs because someone else owns it. So it's that sort of weird mix between public and private sphere that people seem to feel they have over their abutting properties. And yeah, I mean, property values are the number one thing I hear about. And, you know, people have legitimate concerns about their entire future and you don't want to dismiss it, but you need to weigh it accurately.
Well, one example I like to think about for this problem is, you know, I'm in a single family house. And if I had a really big family, if let's say there's 8 people living in my house and we had 4 cars, my neighbors wouldn't think of complaining about that. But if I wanted to turn it into a two-family with two four-person families and four cars, then it would be a public question about density and neighborhood change. And so we have these really funny notions of what you can and can't do with your land and where people should be able to say something and have influence when they shouldn't. Mm. And I think that creates the big challenge of housing politics.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. It's like you can shove as many people as you want in that house, but as soon as you add another door, then we need to get the whole neighborhood involved. And I think Montreal stands out a little bit, like tons of front doors, tons of missing middle housing. So I don't know what they did over there, but not what Toronto did. So you already gave us some examples of policies that we can sort of use to change this. But I guess I want to know, what are some of the barriers that you perceive to action actually happening to change this?
Yeah, I mean, so some of the most effective policy solutions to this in the United States in recent years have actually really come from the state level. So in states like Oregon, California, and Massachusetts, there have been different types of state level legislation, which have basically been designed to take away this discretionary review process at the local level and essentially say, you local governments need to make it possible to build multifamily housing by right without this sort of lengthy discretionary review process. And we think this is sort of the most effective policy solution because fundamentally, there are some communities out there that will voluntarily change their zoning to make it easier to build. There are some places where there have been really vibrant pro-housing movements, where there are large numbers of renters that are really politically active, where I think those local level changes can occur. But there are also a lot of deeply exclusionary communities that will never voluntarily change their zoning. And so I think to fundamentally have equity development to build the housing we need and not have it all get concentrated in a few places, We need to have state level solutions to make sure that everyone is doing sort of their fair share. When you ask about obstacles, I think the really interesting question that states like California and Massachusetts right now are actually experiencing is how much those local governments are going to comply with the state and what actions the state is willing to take to push against those local governments. Another challenge in Montana was actually another state that recently passed innovative state legislation, and there's been some interesting court challenges to that state legislation. So I think that's sort of another potentially interesting obstacle, sort of how the courts think about these different state level changes to zoning.
Are the local governments suing the state? Like, is that sort of happening?
Yeah, so there are some places, where there's like the cities or towns are challenging the state government, but then there also are separately, these sort of groups, which, David was talking about in Montana, that are suing to stop zoning. So it comes both from the public and the private sector.
Wow.
And, Katie mentioned judges, and the Montana example is interesting, where the state legislature and the governor signs new legislation to increase density, and a group opposing it got a court to put an injunction in place that's not in effect yet. And that just happens. That's all ongoing. But in some other work, we found that almost everybody involved in the policy process, city councilors, mayors, state legislators, governors, judges, are all homeowners. And so almost all the decision makers are coming at this from the perspective of a homeowner and thinking about property values and thinking about how they might perceive these things in their own communities. The voices of renters are very disproportionately small in comparison, especially among decision makers.
I don't know how you quite go bringing renters more into the mix. So,
but I'm not even talking about the people at the meetings. I'm talking about the decision makers. So judges are overwhelmingly homeowners, members of Congress, every political office you can think of. And so it's just the biases they might bring from their own experiences as homeowners will inform these debates also. And that's a huge structural challenge.
Right. These biases are sort of embedded at every level. I guess to tie things up here, this book was published in 2019, and we've had a pandemic since, some 4 years-ish. So I guess I just wanted to ask, any major changes you've noticed since this book was published? Any worth passing on that give you hope or the opposite?
So two things I'd want to flag. The first, we actually did a follow-up evaluation of how the move to Zoom affected community meetings. and things stay exactly the same. Like Zoom doesn't change anything, which if you want to take a silver lining from that, I think some folks were worried about whether, you know, potentially senior citizens who might not have sort of the technological expertise might be dissuaded from participating in government, but they found a way. And so they are still very overrepresented in our data on Zoom public hearings. So Zoom is not a panacea, which like maybe we know that from all of the other different ways that Zoom has impacted our day-to-day lives. So that's sort of one narrow piece that technology can't fix this. I think the piece that has been really exciting to see in the intervening years since this book was published has been the sort of growth in a pro-housing movement in a number of different communities. And we've seen, you know, we talked already about a number of different states have passed, I think, really exciting legislation recognizing that local governments controlling housing development, again, on this project-by-project basis, is fundamentally not working and that we need higher levels of government to take action. And there has been a vibrant pro-housing movement, I think, really supporting legislators and taking that action in some places. So I think that's been super exciting.
One area we've been looking at a lot is in Massachusetts. There was a legislation called the MBTA Communities Act that required cities and towns with MBTA or mass transit stops in or near their communities to upzone and create different amounts of zones where multifamily housing of different densities could be built by right. And this is it's new, and several communities have already adopted new zoning. The rest of the state or the rest of the communities have to do it by the end of next year. And while we've seen some pushback, we've also seen towns largely comply, maybe not building to the maximum or upzoning to the maximum level, but at least allowing what's required by law. And part of that's from the state taking a really strong position and saying there will be consequences for towns that don't do this. And we haven't seen that tested yet, but at least that threat appears to be effective so far. And so we're seeing some movement towards this recognition that we need more areas where you can build by right and that we need more density. And so we've seen that here and in some other places sort of as one hopeful sign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some hope I can report from my end too. I mean, I can't speak for all of Canada, but in British Columbia, they actually just released some new legislation that removes public hearings for any rezoning that is already compliant with the official plan. So hopefully that means minor rezonings won't need a public hearing. So yeah, I've definitely seen that change as well. So very happy to see that.
Well, Dr. Einstein, Dr. Glick, and Dr. Palmer, thank you so much for your time and all your work. We really appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That's all for now. I really hope you enjoyed. A big thanks to Dr. Catherine Einstein, Dr. Maxwell Palmer, and Dr. David Glick for co-authoring the book we spoke about. To get the book we spoke about, Neighborhood Defenders, and learn more about the authors and their work, see the links in the show notes. Please give us a review to let us know what you think of the show and share it if you know someone who might like to listen. To keep the conversation going and for updates on new episodes, follow us at DenseCityPod on Twitter and Instagram, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening right now. If you have an idea for a future episode, send us a voice note at the link in the episode description or get in touch with us on Twitter or Instagram to let us know. A special thanks to Emily Wang of Emily H. Illustrations for creating the artwork for this podcast. You can see more of her work by following the link in the show notes. Thanks as well to Reed Kai and Ryan Kinnear for the show music. See you next time on Dense City.